Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. It is Monday, November the 12th. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thank you for joining me here today. You can catch back episodes of Connecting Faith at myfaithradio.com. You can always communicate with me there via email, carmen at myfaithradio.com. You can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. I want to lead off this morning or this afternoon or tonight, whenever you're listening, with the headlines out of California, which continue to be like literally devastating. And I want to highlight actually several different headlines and the words that are used to describe these deadly fires. And so from USA Today, we have like Dante's Inferno, campfire equals deadliest in California history. From another news outlet, we have hell in paradise. Town is wiped off the map. We have the fire being described as furious, continuing its deadly assault, raging. And we have Governor Brown calling it the new abnormal. And so I want to talk a little bit about language, about the language that's used to describe what is natural phenomenon, natural events, and yet give us opportunities to reconnect the eternal with the everyday and actually engage with people in very substantive conversations. So let's just start with how grievous all of this is and how grim it is. The death toll stands, as far as I know right now, at 31, although there are 228 people still unaccounted for. An entire town called Paradise has been literally wiped off the map. And many folks whose names you would recognize, Hollywood's elite and Nashville's elite, their homes have burned to the ground on the cliffs of Malibu. But thousands of regular folks whose names we will never know have lost their homes as well and fled in what is described and chronicled online as just absolute terror. So as we see the images and we read the headlines and we hear the stories of survivors, we hear them offer up themes of gratitude for the preservation of life. We hear the very real fear of death. And we hear them express the very honest trauma of loss. These would be the prevalent themes that we hear. It does not take long, however, in fact, a few paragraphs into any one of these articles, it doesn't take very long for us to arrive at accusations and blame. There is a very robust debate, if you are on social media, about whether or not changes in the climate and or changes in the population density and or changes in the forest management and controlled burns, you know, who's to blame? There's a lot of finger pointing. And when folks are, you know, rightly so, thanking and praising the firefighters, there are also people at town meetings pointing fingers, like literal fingers, asking, you know, why so-and-so's home was protected and theirs was not. So the blame game starts because the grief is real and somebody wants somebody to be responsible. So fire is, by its very nature, indiscriminate. It makes victims of the rich and poor alike, the rural and the suburban, the inland and the coastal. I mean, it is literally indiscriminate. And it can be, when whipped up by the wind and when the forest ground and the trees are dry, as they are in California right now, brittly so. I mean, it turns into what is now described as a firestorm. We even remember the language of fire volcano or fire tornado, excuse me, which was new to us. The last time that we had this uptick in fires in California. So the governor of California has described this as having arrived at a new abnormal. We've heard the language of like a new normal before, but this is the first time I've heard it phrased this way, and I thought I would highlight it. And then I thought I would also take a moment to highlight the person who, when interviewed, described this as like Dante's Inferno. All you could see in every direction was red and black. That was John Yates, 65, an evacuee who was interviewed. He said it looked just like Dante's Inferno. It was black and it was red, and that was all that you could see. So I want to talk about these two things quickly. The concept of a new abnormal and the opportunity to use what an evacuee has said in terms of referring to this is just like Dante's Inferno, and actually then using that in leveraged conversations today with others, probably those outside of California, because I'm not talking about having conversations with people who are in the midst of their own grief. Like, for them, we just weep with those who weep. But the rest of us who are further away and actually can have conversations about these things should be having those conversations. And so what does it mean for the governor to say we are in a new abnormal? When was reality normal? When were things normal? Is there a point in time? And I could like have this conversation with Governor Brown. Like, was there a time when you would say things were normal? And when was that? What makes this seem so abnormal? And when does abnormal, frankly, become so common that we then start describing it as the new normal instead of the new abnormal? Those are the kinds of conversations I think you and I, those are the kinds of questions that we could pose, because it's stimulating, they're open-ended, they make people think, they get us thinking about what we're thinking about. And that's ultimately what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to engage people in substantive conversation about the issues of the day, and then we're going to reconnect the eternal with the everyday. So you and I are going to enter into this conversation at some point when people are fishing around for answers to these questions and they're finding none. We're going to say, well, you know what? Reality was actually normal. The standard of normalcy is actually Genesis 1 and 2. Standard of normalcy. That's when things were normal. That's when things were as they were supposed to be. That's, by definition, what normal is. Yes, things were good before the fall, which occurs in Genesis chapter 3. And since then, since Genesis chapter 3, we have lived in the abnormal state of sin. But we got very used to the abnormal state, and we began to think that it was normal. And this abnormal state of sin has very real consequences. Firestorms, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes. That is normal for a creation that is groaning with eager longing for man's redemption. But it's not normal in terms of the way it was originally supposed to be. So while I do not suspect that this is at all what the governor had in mind when he was talking about this, this is, in fact, the truth about reality. And it's our job as Christians who know the truth to bring the truth to bear in the conversations of the day and to do so with genuine love and concern for others. So I think it's quite notable that the town that has been wiped off the map is called Paradise. So as you listen to those who fled talking about, you know, leaving Paradise, and those surveying the damage are talking about Paradise will never be what it once was. And you hear this evacuee saying it was like Dante's Inferno. Excuse me. It was like Dante's Inferno. Paradise is now hell. And there's actually an article entitled Hell in Paradise. Now, as a Christian, I think that's a wide open door to talk about the reality of the real everlasting paradise and the reality of hell and the difference between the two and the presence and power and redeeming love of God that makes it possible for us to migrate from what would be the consequence of sin in hell forever to the wonder of paradise forever. On this day, you will be with me in paradise. That's Jesus' language for the reality of being with him. Now, we're going to have these conversations with great sensitivity. Now is absolutely and most certainly the time to grieve with those who grieve and console those who wait for news about the hundreds of people who remain unaccounted for. Hey, anytime you hear that phrase, unaccounted for, wow, I want you to remember that one of the ways that God reveals himself is as Elroy, the God who sees. There is not one person in all of creation who is unaccounted for by God. I want you to stop and consider that for a moment. We describe people as unaccounted for. For those who live with an awareness of God, the God who sees, he is taking it all into account. God is the God who numbers the hairs on our head, the days of our lives, and there is no one unaccounted for God or by God. So as you pray the news today, particularly with California in your heart and mind, I want you to pray for calm winds and lower temperatures and rain. Pray for safety and success and stamina for the firefighters and those who are charged with the very grim task of identifying bodies and notifying families. And as we approach Thanksgiving, maybe you could consider how you and your family might do something to alleviate this now grievous loss of our neighbors in California. If you just go on Google and type in ways to help California fire or California fire relief, you're going to see there are lots and lots of options and ways to help. Continuing our focus today on California, we're going to turn next to consider the events of last week in Thousand Oaks, California, the devastation wrought by one individual who was intent on wreaking mayhem and death. We all want to know how to better prepare ourselves and our families and proactively prevent mass shootings from occurring in the future. So up next, I'm going to be joined by retired police chief and mass shooting expert John Matthews. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and you're listening to Connecting Faith.
No matter what I face, you're by my side. When you don't move the mountains.
Hey friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Welcome back. My conversation partner today is John Matthews. John is a highly decorated former chief of police. He's the founder of the Community Safety Institute in Dallas. He's worked for years with school systems, event venues, and corporations across the country, as well as the federal government, on active shooter prevention and response models. He appears regularly on CNN and Fox News, and he is the author of several books, including Creating a Safer School, Countering Terrorism, Protecting Our Schools and Communities, and Mass Shootings, Six Steps to Survival. John Matthews, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, Carmen.
So, John, I think that sadly we're growing like strangely accustomed to the news of another mass shooting at a school or a church or a concert or a bar or someone's workplace. So talk with us about the rise, sort of this rising tide that we're seeing in mass shootings in America today.
Well, yeah, and we don't want to grow accustomed to it. That's one of the key points is this should shake every American, you know, to its bones every time we have that. And as a dad, as a father of six, every time I see something, you know, I go back, I talk to my family, we visit about it. And, you know, I want them to understand that in today's environment, if we're out and we're in a public place, we've got to be aware of our surroundings. We've got to be aware of our situation, and we have to know how to handle ourselves. And it's unfortunate that you have to have these talks, that you have to visit with your kids before you send them off to school or before you go out to a carnival or a concert or even a movie theater for that matter. But it's better to be proactive. It's better to be prepared than to just say, oh, well, you know, there's nothing I can do about it, because there's a lot of things that we can do about it. And that's the important message we need to tell our kids.
Okay, that's going to be really encouraging for people to hear. So why don't you just give us an example? What is the kind of conversation? You may even think of a specific time that you had a conversation with one or more of your children. And maybe you could give us a sense of, you know, at the different ages and stages of life as they're growing up, how those conversations evolve over time as well.
Well, I certainly can, because my kids are spread out over almost 30 years. And so I've seen them grow up, and I've seen the different generations and everything. And let me tell you, when I talk with my youngest and we talk about the latest school shooting, and she comes home and said, Dad, you know, why did those kids run with their backpack? It gives me that learning opportunity, that teaching opportunity to say, that's right, honey. You know that if you're ever in a situation, you need to run quickly. You need to shed your backpack. You need to take off your long coat, you know, and talk about those things. And we talk about them in an age-appropriate manner. I talked to my teenagers and said, the GPS on your phone is not for me to spy on you. It's for me to know where you are. And if something happens, I can get a hold of you and let you know, listen, you're in this community. This is what's going on. I want you to be aware. I want you to know. It's to allow us to prepare for things. When we go out to a concert, I can tell everybody, okay, everybody's got a phone, pull it out, we're going to ping it on the map, and we're going to designate this spot as our reunification site. So remember, if we get separated in the crowd, we're at the state fair, whatever we're at, we're all going to this coffee shop on this corner, and that's where we're going to meet up. So I try to take all of these horrific events, turn them into teaching opportunities, and in an age-appropriate level, visit with my family about what we can do. And this even goes to visiting with my parents who are now elderly, have mobility issues. We can talk to them about things like, if you're in this situation, if you're in a restaurant, it's even more important for you with some mobility issues to be by a door, to be by a window, to be by somewhere where you can take cover. So it really spans the gamut from the youngest to the oldest in society that we can visit with them, meet with them, and teach them every time one of these events happens.
Friends, my conversation partner is John Matthews. John, where can folks find you and the kind of information that you're sharing? Can we give them a place to go for that?
Yeah, they can just go to the website, communitysafetyinstitute.org. It's all one word, communitysafetyinstitute.org, and we do trainings all over the country with schools, with churches, corporations. We come in and talk to you about how you can survive these active shooter events. We talk to you about situational awareness, and we visit with you about talking to your family at home.
Okay, John. So let's, as you were saying those things, I was actually like realizing, okay, I do a lot of those things. I instinctively, when I walk into a building, I walk into a room, particularly one that I know is going to be crowded, particularly one where everybody's going to be facing forward and looking in one direction. I am normally as far to the front as possible, as far to one side as possible, because that's where I know the exits are. And that's where the least likely entrance is for somebody who might seek to do me harm. When I go into a restaurant, I normally ask for a seat where I'm actually facing the door, so that I can see what's coming. Are those the kinds of things that when we're encouraging people to just simply take responsibility for themselves, are those the kinds of things you're talking about? Is that situational awareness? Because I don't know that language.
Yeah, that's exactly what situational awareness is. You can make it even more basic for younger kids. You can sit at a table in a restaurant and play the what if game. What if something were to happen, and it doesn't have to be a shooter, by the way? You know, what if there was a tornado outside and we could see it outside the front door? Where would we run to? And it goes beyond, you know, knowing the way you came in, because everybody instinctively tries to go out the way they came in. Look for the kitchen, knowing that there's a delivery door in the kitchen, knowing that there's a restaurant supply door, knowing that there's an exit into an alleyway. So you want to be aware of not just the main entry and exit points, because everybody's going to rush to those. You're going to want to know other areas that you're aware of to say, yes, I see them using this doorway all the time. It's got to go to this area that'll get me out of the shooter's line of sight. It'll take me to an area where I can find cover. Those are the types of things, raising situational awareness to the next level, and you can do it by playing the what-if game.
Oh, I love that. And I love that as an age-appropriate example for, you know, for kids. I think that is really helpful. Hey, friends, let me just remind you again that you can find the kind of information that we're talking about and resources at communitysafetyinstitute.org. John Matthews is my conversation partner today, and we're talking about, you know, sort of the sad new reality of where we live, not only in relationship to mass shootings, but the reality that, you know, I don't know, it just seems like disaster is always a little bit closer to us than we might like to admit. I'm thinking, John, that even, you know, even folks who live in California, the disaster is a fire. But the reality is I would have needed a point of getting back together, a reunification site that was way outside of my community. Like sometimes I think we don't think in a bandwidth far enough out So can you talk a little bit about...
You're exactly right. Let me tell you another thing that we do. You know, you talked about outside of your community. We want to, in this day and age, let me tell you, I'm the worst about it. I hit speed dial, right? I probably can't tell you more than two or three numbers, and I probably have 1,000 on my phone. But one of the things we talk to the kids about is memorizing a phone number for a relative or friend that is out of state. And so that everybody will call that relative or friend that is out of state to say, hey, I know you're out of this impact area, wildfire, hurricane, earthquake, whatever it is, but mom said to call you to let you know I'm okay and I'm at this location. That way your out-of-state friend or relative can coordinate reunifying all of your family or all of your friends. Just another kind of helpful technique for you.
Okay, now that is a good challenge. I am sitting here thinking about, other than my mom and my sister, people who live out of state, whose phone numbers do I know? That's it. I only know those two. So that is a really good challenge. And I guarantee you that my husband doesn't know those phone numbers off the top of his head.
Well, and that's why we bring people in and talk about things like this. It's our job to think about these things so you don't have to. But again, these are all teachable moments, and these are ways that we can not only help ourselves to survive, but our kids, our families, our friends to survive. And there are techniques, there are tactics that you can use in all of these different all-hazard situations. And so having a contact number out, you know, out of state or out of your immediate region, you know, having things pre-programmed on your phone, having the different apps that are out there where you can see where everybody is and contact them and let them know about an emergency. There's all different things that we can be doing that help us to prepare. So once you have that level of preparedness, you add situational awareness to it, and you learn some of the 6 steps that we teach in the Surviving a Mass Shooting course. Now you have 3 different levels of protection that's going to keep your family safe and secure.
John Matthews, I really genuinely appreciate what you're doing. I'm so sorry that you have to do it. But friends, you can find more information about what we're talking about today at communitysafetyinstitute.org. John Matthews, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen. Have a good day.
You too. Hey, friends, the reality of what we learn often after a mass shooting is that mental health it plays a part and plays a role. There seems to be a genuine connection today between America's mental health crisis and the kinds of things that we are experiencing at the hands of one another. And so Bruce Ashford is going to join me next to talk candidly about his own experience of depression, how it was tied to loneliness, and how Christ redeems us from both, because we don't want those who are struggling out there to be isolated and alone. And we as Christians need to find ways to actively re-engage with them and bring the healing and hope of Jesus Christ to bear. So I'm Carmen LaBurge. You are listening to Connecting Faith. And when we come back, I'll be joined by Bruce Ashford for a conversation, candid conversation, about his own experience of depression and redemption from it. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, one of my personal favorite conversation partners, Bruce Ashford. He has been with us before here on Connecting Faith. He's also appeared on every other faith radio program that you can think of. He's one of our favorites. He serves as the provost and professor at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's an elder at his local church. He's a regular contributor to Fox News Opinion and the Gospel Coalition. He's a husband and a dad. He blogs at bruceashford.net. He's authored several books, including Letters to an American Christian, which we featured in a conversation here on Connecting Faith, and Every Square Inch. Bruce, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, it's great to be back on the show. I appreciate you having me on.
So absolutely. You know, you're a joy to talk with, and you're welcome anytime. I appreciate that today you've agreed to talk with me about something that is deeply personal, not just for you, but for many of our listeners. We are sort of openly recognizing that, and when I say mental health concerns, right, I'm talking about a really broad spectrum of issues that people deal with. Depression is at one end of that spectrum. And so thank you for agreeing to talk about your own experience of depression, how it's connected to loneliness. And then, you know, and then we can move into a conversation about, you know, how Jesus is the answer to both of those things. So if you would be so gracious, just tell us a little bit about your own experience with depression.
Yeah, you know, so this sort of this topic, the reason I wrote an article on it is a study came out, I guess a couple months ago now, that said that basically where some sociologists did this massive study, and their conclusion was that lonely people benefit from having a relationship with God. And I think for those of us who are Christians, most of us would say that seems pretty intuitive and doesn't seem surprising. But for sociologists to publish it and for the facts to be out there really surfaced for me a couple of things. Before I get to the personal, it surfaced the fact that over the past few years, there have been a number of studies and basically that talk about a loneliness epidemic in Western society and in the U.S., that we have more people that are lonely, and loneliness and depression are not the same thing, but loneliness often is a cause of depression, and depression often causes loneliness. And so they're very closely tied together. And the epidemic is so bad that former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy actually called it an epidemic, said that it causes an insidious type of stress that leads to heart disease, dementia, clinical depression, anxiety, all of these things. It's no respecter of persons. You know, you'll find lonely people among the people who are married, among people who are extremely popular, have millions of fans, celebrities, among people who are married, people who are not married. And so it can afflict, you know, any kind of person. It does remind me for, you know, right along about the time that I started a PhD program, and I was in my early to mid-20s and on up through until my early 30s, I went through a period of probably 6 to 8 years of clinical depression. I hid it from people. Hardly anybody knew it, and I hid it from myself. Didn't want to admit it to myself, and I wasn't a person who was alone necessarily. I was single, but I was surrounded by people, and yet I was still lonely, and I think my loneliness was one of the things that led to my depression, and my depression then reinforced my loneliness. And I think there's a lot of people out there who are very lonely and even clinically depressed and lonely and have been unwilling to admit it publicly and maybe even admit it to themselves.
So I feel like, Bruce, that you know, for those of us who are Christians and therefore engaged in the life of local congregations, local churches, we ought to be, first of all, it ought to be a safe place for us to admit that, you know, although I come to this place and I'm surrounded by people, although I'm supposedly a part of a body and intimately connected to it, and I'm supposedly a part of a fellowship, I'm not feeling that. Can you maybe describe how a person would go about initiating that kind of conversation from a place of, you know, you're already not feeling good, but loneliness, I think, if we allow it to become isolation, is then really problematic.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the worst thing you can do if you're lonely and or depressed is to isolate yourself. And that's really what I did, essentially, during that period of my life. Is I isolated myself as much as I could without making it obvious that I was doing so. I think one of the important things to do is to reach out to somebody. And don't reach out to the superstar in your church, necessarily. If you've got a senior pastor in a church with 1,000 people, you know, he could be one person you reach out to. Reach out, pray that God will give you wisdom and discernment about who to reach out to. And, you know, psychotherapists say that 40% of their success with a client is determined by the quality of relationships that the client has outside of the counseling office. And the kind of relationship that a lonely person needs is not necessarily a lot of office appointments with a lead pastor. or with the most popular person in the church, and sometimes that's who a lonely person might reach out to. And I would just encourage them to take a look around at who are the warm-hearted and relationally minded, wise people who love the Lord, and reach out to them and see if they're the kind of person who can help. And I think it's on us as the church, though, from the other end of things, to look for people who are lonely. You know, the church needs to be a place where we make eye contact with people, where we touch them, you know, appropriately, you know, give a handshake or a hug, where we engage in some conversation without prying, just ask if people are doing okay. And I don't think we do a great job of that. We don't do as good of a job as we should. But I agree with you that the church is exactly the sort of community, sort of place of belonging that a lonely person needs.
So I had an interesting experience with a person who was quite evidently special needs, young person, first time at the church, or at least first time I was aware of this person being at the church. Obviously, they might have been there before, but it was my sense that they were there. It was their first time. And for whatever reason, they walked right up to me in a fairly filled up gathering area with two very direct questions. Where's the share table and where's the friend bench? I said, I'm so sorry. What? You know, could you repeat that? Where's the, very definitively, like, I should know this. Like, this was, the way the question was asked was almost like, okay, you got to be kidding me. You don't know? Like, right. So where's the share table and where's the friend bench? Well, about that time, an adult who was clearly with this young person also arrived and smiled broadly. And I said, I need a little bit of interpretation. You know, he's asking about the share table and the friend bench. Well, she went on to say that at school, they have a share table, and anybody who wants to share something or has something to share or wants to be shared with, like, you know, you're in need of, right, you sit at the share table. And outside at recess, and, you know, and other times that they're outside, you go to the friend bench, and there are other kids at school who are clued in that if anybody goes and sits at the friend bench, you head that direction, because that's a person saying, I really need a friend, or I really need some. So I'm standing there in the church thinking, why don't we have a share table? Why don't we have a friend bench? You know, so I will admit to you that there are ways in which we can learn, I think, particularly from sort of like the life skills special ed folks at our schools, the anti-bullying folks, the folks who are in environments where they're actively looking for particularly young people who've isolated themselves. But we need to be looking for even older people who have experiences of isolation and depression and are lonely for all kinds of other life reasons.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, another study that came out, a set of studies actually, and this is pretty intuitive, is that the rise of social media has caused loneliness, right? It's been an unsocial medium. And what's happened is, so traditionally, historically, people have had, you know, we could put their relationships in three different categories. One is family members and close friends. You've only got room for 15 or 20 of them in your life, someone who you're really close to. Then a second group you would have would be people who are distant and far, far away that you only see every once in a while. But there was a middle layer of people that you would see regularly. That would be people in your church, people in the neighborhood, and in the grocery store, and so forth. What's happened in the age of social media is that most of our friendships are either in the first category or the third. And the third category would be, you know, the people who are distant. These are affinity-based social media, quote-unquote, friendships. We're out there playing on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and so forth. And then we've got so that's the third category, distant. Then we have a few people we're close to, family and friends. But that middle category of people, church community, neighborhood, they're gone, done with, because all of our attention is on social media. And so I think the church needs to work really hard, like you're saying, to create some third spaces where people are in a room together, face-to-face, you know, practicing the one another's. The Bible gives these one another commands over and over and over again, because Christianity is a face-to-face relationship. You can't have church online. You're gathering with actual people. Just to go through the Bible's narrative in a minute or less, creation, God created us to be people in community. He made us, in Aristotle's words, to be social animals. Now, I won't call us animals, but we're social beings. Then at the fall, when we broke our relationship with God through sin, that also ruptured our relationship with other people. And then in redemption, Christ comes to us as the exemplar of being in right relationship with God the Father and with others. And he lived his life in community, not only with his normal family, but with 12 disciples. And then on the cross, he took our sin and pain and even our loneliness upon his shoulders. And in turn, in exchange, as we embrace him, he reconciles us to himself. And what's more, he offers us a community, the church. And it's not a perfect community. It's an imperfect community, full to the brim. In fact, it's the only kind of people you'll find in a church are imperfect people. But that imperfect place is the place where God wants to meet us in the midst of our loneliness.
And that's, you know, I think the message for each and every one of us who are Christians, whether or not we've had our own experiences of depression, it's hard for me to imagine that everybody listening hasn't had some, at least episodic depression in their life. I mean, that's the reality of the rhythms of life brings at least episodic depression. But I do think that one of the things that we're talking about is depression that sinks in and settles in to the point where it breeds isolation. And so let's be people who are not only enjoying the fellowship of the community of God's people and redemption in Jesus Christ, but actually ministers of reconciliation, where we are genuinely reaching out in love and grace to invite other people into not only a reconciled relationship with God, but a substantially restored relationships with other people. And so, Bruce, thank you so much for raising our attention to this, raising our awareness of it, writing about it at bruceashford.net, and talking with us about it here today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you. It's been so great to talk with you again and be on the show. And for all of you out there in radio land, let me just encourage you, don't isolate yourself if you are lonely. Take what God's given you, which is the church, and immerse yourself in that community.
Amen. Bruce Ashford, folks can follow you on Twitter at Bruce Ashford. I know that it's social media, but it is at least a way of engaging.
Thank you, Carmen.
Right. Hey, thanks, Bruce. Have a great day. God bless.
Okay.
All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am counting every blessing, letting go and trusting when I cannot. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Let's spend a few minutes making the connecting point. I had an opportunity this weekend to spend some, what I'll describe as retreat time, right? Retreating from everything else in life, away to a place in the mountains with a total of, there were 27 of us, so 26 other women. And it was, I'm just going to go ahead and confess, I'm not really a women's retreat kind of person, or at least I didn't think I was until this retreat. So now I'll say, you know, I'm this kind of women's ministry retreat person. I had a wonderful time. It was very edifying. It was a wonderful opportunity to engage with other women of faith who are genuinely, you know, substantive and personally seeking the Lord and desiring deeply to be deployed by him in service and in ministry. And so one of the conversations that bubbled up throughout the course of our time together was this sort of open acknowledgement that that the church sometimes sees itself, or we see it, we, the lay people, sometimes see the church as like primarily functioning as a place of preaching and teaching. And so we go there to get some preaching and we go there to get some teaching instead of recognizing that the church is much more than just preaching and teaching. Now, certainly preaching and teaching or on preaching and teaching, I certainly place a very high premium. I absolutely think that it is the church that must be handling the word of God rightly. And that's not happening, and we talk about that a lot. That's not happening in some churches, and we talk about that a fair amount. So I'm certainly not suggesting here that preaching and teaching are not important. Preaching and teaching are of paramount importance, but they are not the only thing that the church is designed to do and be. There is more to the church than what happens from the pulpit or from the lectern. in the sanctuary or even in the classrooms. There's this, supposed to be this rhythm of a shared life. And that rhythm of a shared life needs, of necessity, I mean, if it's going to be a genuine community, if it's going to be a real body, then of necessity, it includes knowing one another well enough that when my brother or sister in Christ hurts, when they're hurting, I don't just casually say, I'm praying for you, and then move on and maybe pray for them and maybe not pray for them. I like hit my knees as if I myself were experiencing whatever it is that they're experiencing. Like a body, a real fellowship, a real family feels deeply the joys and the pains of other members of it. But I'm not sure that in most churches we know one another well enough that we would hit our knees in ardent prayer for one another, presenting our petitions before the Lord in one, you know, with one voice, in faith and hope and confidence, but with pleading. So I think that we also don't always embody our prayer life in what I would describe as a care life. And so the church is not just a place of preaching and teaching and prayer. It is also a place of care, a people of care, a community of care and concern. And so what does that look like? And one of the conversations that that I've been having with others is this reality that the ambassadors of a kingdom don't just pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Ambassadors actually show up to bring the kingdom priorities of the king to bear in the kingdoms of this world. Like, we don't just pray for God to have his kingdom come and his will be done on earth as in heaven. We actually, as ambassadors of the kingdom, as agents of grace, as ministers of reconciliation, we actually walk that out into the world. We bring kingdom principles and kingdom priorities, like, to bear. We make it visible. We demonstrate what the kingdom of heaven is like in the midst of this world. So what does it look like to actually live out the principles and priorities of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this world right now, today, where we live? That is what reconnecting the eternal with the everyday actually means. That's what, you know, being gospel people and living out the gospel always and in all ways actually, like, means and looks like. So we can't be people who just care about issues. We have to be people who care about people and care for people. I don't know about you. I hope this is true. We as people of the church, we cannot expect the government or somebody else to care for or take care of people who are broken or hurting or anxious or confused or lonely or depressed or isolated or angry. Like, we have to care with real acts of compassion, with genuine outreach. We take responsibility. If we're actually able and we're actually able to respond, then we have to take responsibility for what's in front of us to do in terms of kingdom advancement. And so, yes, there is evangelism, but there must of necessity also be the kind of discipleship that that Jesus demonstrated, which is, hey, come and see, come along with me, inviting people into our life, along the path of our life, in such a way that they can actually, like, see what a Christian life looks like. But that means that I got to be living out that Christian life in every arena of life, in what Bruce Ashford and before him others have described as every square inch. That is Kuyper or Kuypernian theology, if you're interested in knowing where that phrase comes from, because it's, I would say it's my operating philosophy as well in terms of ministry. So, the truth is, you know, I'm clearly not the first person who said this. This is actually kind of a worn out phrase, but it's very meaningful. People actually don't care what we think, or they don't really care to listen to us. They don't care to hear us out until we have cared enough to actually hear them out and serve them substantially. So all of this sort of got wound up this weekend in one person's story, and I will say that as she shared her testimony, I was really cut to the heart, acknowledging that there have probably been a lot of people over the course of time who have walked into churches where I have been. I mean, I'm in church a lot, so I feel fairly confident this has probably happened. And I have not noticed that they were, first of all, by themselves, and second of all, in a place for the first time that was very uncomfortable for them, a foreign environment, like literally a person arriving on a foreign shore who doesn't know the language, doesn't know the customs, probably isn't dressed like everyone else is dressed, doesn't know where to sit, doesn't know how to follow the bulletin or what's up on the screen, doesn't know the words we're using. I mean, it's foreign. The whole thing is foreign to them. Doesn't have a Bible, you know, and wouldn't know where to turn with me to the Gospel of John and let's stand and read together. Like, that's just not going to happen for a person who's there for the first time. And so this individual was sharing that after having a quite remarkable conversion experience from a life of prostitution, she went to church. It happened to be Christmas. On the way to church, she bought a dress that she thought would be appropriate, but the neighborhood in which she lived, let's just say church dresses, were not really what was for sale. But it was the only thing that she owned that she thought would be appropriate for church. And she now says, it clearly wasn't. It clearly was not church appropriate. But I was there, and it was Christmas, and no one talked to me. We went on to have a conversation about the reality that there are no bad girls. There are girls and there are women who have been told so many lies about themselves over the course of their life, so many lies about love, that they have been led to make some very bad decisions, sometimes over and over and over again. And they need mercy, not condemnation. And so today, I mean, I can celebrate that this individual is actively engaged in ministry to women who are trafficked or in otherwise part of the sex trade. And I can also say that she has absolutely changed the way that I think and perceive what other people are carrying with them into church and what they are hoping to leave at the altar, what they are hoping to leave at the foot of the cross. But they need Christians to walk the distance from the back door or the back pew to the cross. And that is a huge reason that you and I are at church or in church, in order that we can be the people who walk with others on those really scary steps of the journey, which they are at that point taking all by themselves. So I want us to walk by faith, and I want us to walk our faith out into the world today in a new way. Absolutely speaking the truth in love. We're not losing our grip on the truth of the gospel or the reality of who God is and all of his holiness. But we are also recognizing that as people who speak the truth, we do so in love as Christ. We do so in love as Christ. Walking out faith into the world every day and every way in order that other people, right? That's what we're actually interested in, that other people might come to know this great and amazing, redemptive, powerful, joyful, gracious love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Friends, it is Monday, which means that I have posted a must-read Monday at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I do that every Monday because there are frankly so many headlines that I just don't have time to talk about here on air. So if you go to reconnectwithcarmen.com, you can read today's must-read Monday. You can sign up for the email list so you don't ever miss anything. While you're there, I would invite you to consider a Thanksgiving gift to support me in this ministry. If you value what I'm doing and what I'm saying, I'd appreciate hearing from you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. That's all the time we've got here today on Connecting Faith. You can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com, or hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of connecting faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.